I invite you to open the Bibles to the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and continue in our series of lessons from that great chapter. I want to express my appreciation for all of the prayers and concerns have been bestowed on behalf of my cousin Ricky. Several have asked about him. He is at home resting, still has a mild headache, and still very weak. But we are encouraged by the progress and trust that hopefully in the next week or two that he will be back to normal. I had another cousin who said, "I can't imagine little Ricky being still very long," and I agree with that. She said, "He reminds me of one who has AD, triple HD," and I would have to agree with that. He's very active. And I love him dearly, and I just appreciate all the prayers that you've expressed and concern in his behalf. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul says that love is the more excellent way. Love makes us more like God, less like the world, when we learn to have that kind of love. And it was the excellent way for Corinth, and it would be the excellent way for us as well. It influences all the relationships, our relationship with God and our relationship with man. It is indeed the greatest command, because Jesus says that it is the greatest command. And in 1 Corinthians 13, we notice that he lists 16 characteristics of love. He says, tells us what it is, and he tells us what it is not. And again in verse 4, he says, "Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself and is not puffed up." Those last two characteristics are the characteristics that I want us to look at today. To be puffed up, Vine says, means to be inflated with pride. Mac Knight offers also insight into the word. He said it signifies the state of mind of a person who is filled with a high opinion of himself and who, in consequence of that opinion of himself, indulges hatred and wrath against all who fail in paying him the respect he thinks due him. And the reason I mention or put Esther, the sixth chapter, is because this reminds me of that character in Esther named Haman. You remember that Mordecai, the Jew, was his arch enemy, and he had convinced the king that all the Jews were to be destroyed. But, of course, it backfires on him. And there's an occasion in which they're going to have this great banquet, and they're going to give high praise to someone, and Haman thinks he's the one that, I mean, who else would get this honor than him? But what happens is that when he's invited to the banquet, instead Mordecai, the enemy, receives the praise. And then in the 10th verse, he goes home and he's pouting because he didn't get the honor. And ultimately, of course, Haman receives the gallows that he thought had been prepared for Mordecai. Well, ever know anybody like that? Well, if you live long enough, you find somebody like that. What is it that causes people to be proud? Well, first of all, we find that sometimes it is worldly wisdom that would cause men to be proud. The book of 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, the Apostle Paul alludes to that in the 22nd verse, or beginning with verse 21, when he says, "For since the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews request a sign, the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men and the weakness of God is stronger than men." Apparently, every generation has had its group of intellects and scholars, just like in the first century, that would deem the preaching of the cross to be foolish. Today, perhaps it's a college professor that is inflated with pride because of all his intellect and knowledge, that will stand up in a college class and say, "Well, you know, if you believe in God, and if you believe in Jesus, and you believe in the resurrection, then you're just a fool." Sometimes such intellect causes men to be vainly proud. By the same token, we would find that sometimes it is wealth that makes people proud. In the book of 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, we find then that Paul instructs Timothy to give a warning. He says, command those who are rich in this world or in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. It is difficult to be affluent and at the same time to be humble. And perhaps it's a good warning for us to take in a very affluent society and in a very affluent country. Sometimes position and rank, ever hear the old adage that, you know, it all went to his head? In the Gospel of John, the 12th chapter, apparently there were some Jews that Jesus described in the 12th chapter in the 42nd verse when he says, nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. Sometimes success goes to people's head. And it is extremely difficult for one to walk in the light of God and at the same time walk in the limelight of receiving the praise and accolades of men. Religion causes people to be proud. Thus, we notice in Romans, the 2nd chapter, that the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 2 and verse 17 says, indeed, you are called a Jew and rest on the law and make your boast in God and know His will and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and of truth in the law. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? And you who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You make your boast in the law. You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as is it written. Paul says, I want you to know, you Jewish Christians, that some of you just think you're God's gift to man. I've got news for you. And that is, just like the Gentile brother sitting on the pew next to you, you're a sinner and you're in need of the grace of God. Yet you think that you're a guide to the blind. You really think you're something, but the reality is that in God's eyes, you're nothing without the grace of God, without the mercy of God. And it reminds me of the Pharisees who loved the chief seats of the synagogue and the best places at the feast, Jesus said in Matthew, the 23rd chapter. But there's a very practical application of this, because in 1 Timothy chapter 3, the Apostle Paul says that one who is an elder is not to be a novice. Why? Lest by being puffed up, he fall into the snare of the devil. There is simply no room for pride in our religion, in our relationship with Christ, in our relationship with God. And we certainly see this pride at Corinth, do we not? Sophisticated Christians, I call them. First of all, at Corinth they were very prideful about the fact that some of them were gifted. And especially the gift of tongues, especially, seems to be the problem. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 21, Paul says, and the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again to the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather, those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor. Oh, you can't say, well, you know, I'm just so well off and gifted that, well, I don't need that person. No, all the parts of the body are necessary. We need each other. We lean upon each other. But there were some at Corinth that just thought, wow, you know, we are so gifted. We have so much ability. And therefore, they would look down the nose at others. Love doesn't do that. Furthermore, at Corinth, not only were they puffed up about the gifts, but they were even puffed up about sin. Thus in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, he says in verses 1 and 2, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. And you are puffed up, and have not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. Love doesn't justify or tolerate sin. We should have sorrow for sin, and it must be condemned. And the attitude at Corinth was an extremely dangerous attitude. And it would be an extremely dangerous attitude if we had the same attitude about sin today. But don't we have our set of sophisticated Christians in the modern church? For example, those who have not learned to have the servant's heart. I'll tell you a story that kind of disturbs me. I'll leave the names out to protect the innocent. But there's a gentleman that I know, he and his wife for many years have invited people into their home on a weekly basis for Bible study. And I'm sure at his age, he's probably got some old worn out outlines. I'm sure that's probably the case. I'm not saying worn out from the standpoint of not being valuable. I mean the paper's growing yellow. And the story was about a young man that came to him and said, "You know, you really don't need to be teaching this class. You need to let somebody else do it." You know, a lot of people have this "what's in it for me" attitude. It's a very selfish attitude that we find prevalent in our society, and it greatly disturbs me. And there are some people who just seem to be, or to think that somehow they are above the call of duty. That after all, it would be beneath them to wash a bathroom, clean a bathroom, or vacuum the carpet, or whatever duty or responsibility it might be that they were called upon to do. I have a problem. More importantly, I think the Lord has a problem with that attitude. Or what about upgrading the church? You remember the church at Sardis had a reputation that they were alive. Well, reality was that God says, "You're dead." What about when we begin to exalt our, you know, brand new expanded building? When we begin to talk about our educated minister, or our great orator, or our great campaign, or our wonderful Bible classes, when we begin to lift them up, I'm going to tell you what happens. That makes a church weaker, not stronger. Not at all. In fact, there are even some churches that have become so inflated with pride that they would example, for example, a preaching friend of mine who was told that he was going into the community and trying to convert sectarian friends in a loving, kind, but very pointed way. And the elders called him aside and said, "We don't want you doing that. You're upsetting the apple cart." The bottom line was that one of the elders belonged to the Lions Club and he was upsetting some of his friends. Leave them alone. What kind of love is that? Or we want to upgrade the church sometimes by going and falling prey into all kinds of carnal activities that reality for which there is no authority, because we want to look good in the community. Well, I want to tell you how you upgrade the church. The way that you upgrade a local church is if every member lives a godly, God-fearing life that exalts the cross of Jesus. That's how you upgrade a church. And when the pulpit is not about exalting the man, but when the pulpit and the Bible classes and the singing and everything that we do is about exalting the Lord, that's how you upgrade a church. And you know, the Bible talks about this pride. Over and over again, James says, "But he gives more grace." Therefore, he says, "God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." Luke 14 and 1, Jesus said, "Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted." Or again in Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 2, Solomon says, "When pride comes, then comes shame, but with the humble is wisdom." Or again, Solomon says in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 8, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." Love is not puffed up. Love vaunts not itself. You ever know a windbag? You ever talk to somebody, maybe it's the first time you met them and you've known them for perhaps maybe 15 minutes or an hour, and you know all the great things and all their great accomplishments, but know nothing about their faults? The braggart. Actually, there is a relationship between these two, because when someone becomes puffed up, then it manifests itself in the parade. The braggart, the windbag, the one who wants to make you feel small, the one who likes to boast about all their accomplishments, who wishes to make you feel inferior so that they look superior. Well, at Corinth, they certainly had a parade, did they not? Imagine the assemblies that are described in chapters 12, 13, and 14. And in the 14th chapter, we notice that Paul says, "How is it then, brethren, that when you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation? Let all things be done for edification." How is that going to be done? Well, basically, Paul says, "Children, take your turn." In the context, he says, "You'll get your chance to speak, but one at a time." The problem is that you think so much of yourself, and you think that you have to be heard more than anyone else, that you don't even have the time to listen to your brother. That's the problem. You don't have enough love because you think that you're so special and God's gift to man that you have no time even to listen to the opinion of your brother. I'm going to tell you sometime what we need to do when we have a problem with a brother is we need to sit down and keep our mouth shut and listen. Try to understand them. Try to see their perspective. Try to know where they're coming from. I found that to be true. You know, I'll be honest. I sometimes go home and I talk to Nancy and I'll say, "You know, this person really getting under my skin. This person's really beginning to bother me." And she kind of brings me down to earth and first of all tells me that I'm not the center of the universe. And then she says, "Maybe what you need to do is go have lunch with them." Good idea. And what I find is that probably I have more of a problem than they do. Or maybe it's a challenge that they're having in their life that I was not aware of. Something deep inside that would cause them to behave in this way. You see, love doesn't boast itself. It doesn't parade itself. But people want to parade their wealth and their wisdom and their position and their talent. They want to be self-recognized and self-recommended. But Paul says, love doesn't do that. It is not puffed up and does not exalt itself. And you know, there is this common trait in religion. In Luke 18, there is the Pharisee and the publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed and thus with himself, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Extortioners, unjust adulterers, or even as this tax collector, I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess." And the tax collector standing afar off would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." You know what the problem of the Pharisee was? He, rather than God, was the center of his religion. He was the center of his religion. And what he did was, instead of comparing himself to a holy and righteous God, he found somebody else to pick on. "I'm glad I'm not like the publican." And I want you to notice that he has this long, wordy prayer. I fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess, and I'm sure glad I'm not like the publican. But the religion of the publican was seven simple words. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. What kind of attitude do we have? Love does not parade itself. Love learns to have the Spirit of Jesus. The Spirit of Jesus is described by Paul in the book of Philippians, the second chapter in verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Why did God do that? Why did he leave the castles of heaven to be born in a stable, in a manger? Why did he leave the comforts of heaven to come and to nurse from a mother's breast, to be clothed in diapers? And why did he leave the praises of angels to come and to live into a world in which he would be hated and ultimately killed? Would you have done that? Would you have left heaven knowing that most people would reject you? Would you have done that? God did. Why did he do it? Because God loved us. That's why he did it. Because he loved us. One simple word, love. You see, in the kingdom of God, there is no pecking order. In the same context, Paul says in Philippians 2, let each esteem other better than himself. How can I point to God when I am always pointing to myself? And I have a question we need to answer from right now all the way to the back, from this person all the way to the back. What is more important to you? That the work get done or for you to be seen? Good question. Good question. I can tell you the Spirit of Jesus. He came and lived as a carpenter's son. He was mistaken for a gardener. And while he was here, he stooped down and he washed the disciples' feet. And he has done that for me as well, and even greater. He's given me the greatest gift that one could possibly be offered. He came and died on a cross so that I could be exalted far above the heavens, into the heavenly places. Be called a child of God. It doesn't get any better than that. He calls me every day, every Lord's Day, to his table. And every day he gives me a reason to live. For one reason. Because he loved me. Even when I didn't deserve it, he loved me. He loves you too. Perhaps there's a need that he can meet today, one that we're not aware of. But if we can assist you, we certainly would welcome that opportunity. If we can help you in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and sing the song selected.
There's a great day coming. There's a great day coming. There's a great day coming by.